years later. It's just a testament to the writing and that crazy performance. It was awesome. That's when I fell in love with acting. I fell in love with acting right around the time where Wallace started sniffing coke. That was the first moment when I ever lost myself in a character, where I didn't feel like myself, where I was totally zoned in, and Andre Royo really helped me with that. I really fell in love with acting at that moment. Up until that point, it was a lot of imitating or trying to be in the moment. My mind state was play it, make it as real as possible, and just try to get through it. At that age, my mind isn't as developed as now. My strategy, my process, wasn't as developed. It was really raw. That was me as raw as you was gonna get.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
After that, unofficially, we never shook on it or anything like that. David always gave me the penultimate episode of the season. That happened to be the episode where people got killed. By the end of the run, people were wearing t-shirts on set. I didn't even know who made them. It said my name, Pelicanos, and it had a pen with blood dripping on it. Even the actors got to the point where they sort of dreaded the script coming out that I was going to write because, by policy, we would never tell the actor that he or she was going to get killed. We didn't want the performances to get telegraphed. If they knew in the beginning of the season that they were going to get killed in a certain episode, we felt like that might telegraph it. Think about it. When your character is killed in a TV show, it's like somebody handing you a pink slip. You're fired. It's not a pleasant thing. But I always got that penultimate episode, and it's because of the Wallace scene in season one.
Lawrence Gilliard Jr., D'Angelo Barksdale.
I'm maybe 80% prepared when I get to set, because I like to leave a little room for whatever the director's ideas are, whatever the other actors in the room, whatever their ideas are. It's all about collaborating. I didn't prepare. I wasn't at home in the mirror repeating, "Where's Wallace? And I'm gonna look like this. I'm gonna do that." I remember Clement Virgo coming out at one point. There are certain moments when you're working, when the director can just give you a certain look. It's really just a look. They don't have to say anything. He came out and he just gave me this look. I guess I took it up another notch after that. It changed something in my performance. Obviously, with that scene, it took something up a notch. And that was when it really started cooking after that. It was a very emotional scene. And I was just in the moment. You could feel it. I remember. Everybody in the room and around me could feel that it was really happening. That's the magic of it all. That's what you're always striving for when you're acting. When you're on set. When you're in front of that camera. You always want that magical moment where it's really happening until they say cut.
Delaney Williams, Sergeant J. Lanceman.
When Kima gets shot that first season, we had a scene where we're doing the search in the train yard for the shooters. This was a big helicopter nighttime scene, closed down all the streets, and then we spent a lot of time in the train yard looking for evidence where the perpetrators had gone through and got to their getaway car. It was a long, long night, much longer than it should have been because it was in a train yard, and we shot out the scene, and then a train pulls in and stops. And when the train pulls in and stops in a scene that you've already shot, you have a new train and you can't cut between shots. So they had to get the train to move, but to get a train to move out of a train yard is quite an operation. At least an hour and a half to get the right people on the phone to get the train to move out of the train yard so we could finish shooting.
Brian Anthony Wilson, Detective Vernon Holly.
We were shooting a very tense scene where we were in the hospital, and Frankie Faison was cracking jokes, and I had to gain my composure and stop smiling. He's a really funny guy, and he's a very great actor, too, but he keeps it light on the set. There was a lot of tension because it was a somber thing. We're waiting to see if she survives when a cop gets shot.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
I was sort of rather hung up about crying because I thought it was a sign of great acting. It wasn't something I could do very easily. I think a lot of actors, and certainly male actors, are hung up about crying on screen. But for some reason, I thought it was appropriate that I should cry on screen at this point. I had to spend the whole day before in a sort of miserable gloom and thinking about dead babies and trying to get myself into this space. I was hanging around Frankie Faison, fantastic guy and really funny, but I was trying to be deadly serious in between takes to keep in the zone and try and keep the tears coming, which is impossible to do, and a pointless exercise anyway. Frankie kept cracking jokes. I'd made the set really gloomy and no one felt they could speak. It was tense on set because I was acting so hard. It was some sort of music on some radio, sort of a low rap beat, coming out of a speaker somewhere, and Frankie started moving to the beat and going, "Would it be inappropriate if Kima was dying and then we all just started dancing?" It was so funny that I couldn't stop laughing, and I thought, fuck, Frankie really fucked me up. I've lost it, you know? I've come out of the zone. In fact, I think he was trying to lighten things up anyway, because that's the only way you can act it. Then I did the scene, and I tried to cry as much as I could.
Steve Schill, director.
I was completely taken aback by John Doman, addressing McNulty in that scene. It's one of the great pleasures of being a director. You can just sit down. I was just watching TV. I didn't need to direct him in that scene. I just sat there and I was like, oh my God, these guys are making me look so good. I was absolutely, completely taken aback by John Doman's power. He later told me he was a captain in the Marine Corps in a previous life, and he had also worked in advertising on Madison Avenue. And he was an alpha type in the real world. He didn't come to acting until he was in his 40s. That's where that power comes from. It comes from real-life experience.
John Doman, Deputy Ops William A. Rawls.
For me, that was probably the best scene that I had. As an actor, you don't want to have a one-dimensional character, and things like that really make it worth doing. When you can show another side of the character, it makes it so much more interesting.
Anthony Hemingway, director.
There was also a synergy within our production due to the familial nature we like to foster. We love a lot. We laugh a lot. It's the only way to get through the challenging schedules and demands of the job. The first season on most shows are always hard, as you're establishing so many different elements, and The Wire was somehow harder than most because of the complexities of the show. So many actors, shooting all on location, in the real elements, etc. Toward the end of the season, the show started airing while we were still shooting, and it immediately became a hit in Baltimore. We were shooting around the low-rises set when a school bus passed by and all the kids yelled out the window, "Omar, we love you." That was a satisfying moment, knowing that all the blood, sweat, and tears from all was being appreciated.
Donna Adrian Gibson, costume supervisor.
We really became a family, and I think that what helped to develop that was the first 4th of July. Anthony Hemingway and I had a cookout at my house for the people who weren't going to leave to go home. It was really well attended. I'll say maybe 50 people came. We had a really good time. It was not a big deal. We threw some burgers on the grill. Well, the next year, we decided we would do it again, and it just only grew. By the time we were done, it was like 300 people were coming.
David Simon, creator.
It was like the middle of America was hollowed out. The people who were watching the show were either in West Baltimore or North Philadelphia. They were in the places that the show was about, because they couldn't believe there was a drama about their neighborhood. Or it was people who were like book people or whatever who had found it in a weird way. And that's how it felt after 2 or 3 seasons. But man, it took forever.
3. character research. Baltimore and The Wire would become eternally linked in an increasingly layered relationship. The show nearly always filmed on location and established more of a documentary template than that of a traditional television show. Critics argued that The Wire exposed only a negative fragment of Charm City while hurting potential tourism. One city council member proposed a resolution to contradict the bleak image with an upbeat ad campaign. The efforts fell through, but David Simon once wrote in Baltimore Magazine that the city's then mayor, Martin O'Malley, threatened to pull permits to shoot for the show's second season. "We want to be out of The Wire business," O'Malley said, according to Simon. And that conversation arrived before the start of a story thread featuring an ambitious white mayor inspired in part by O'Malley's political rise. Even responses to the show from inside the city's police department varied sizably throughout the years. The department opened its doors to Simon and often hosted actors and writers for ride-alongs. Ed Norris, the police commissioner handpicked by O'Malley, occasionally played a detective by the same name on The Wire. "Show me the son of a bitch who can fix this department," he once demanded on the show. He might as well have delivered a wink to the camera along with the line, "And I'll give back half my overtime." At an Amplify Baltimore event, Commissioner Frederick H. Belfeld III, who arrived 5 years after Norris, derided The Wire as a smear on the city that will take decades to overcome. Belfeld complained that crime shows in other cities showcase models, tough cops, and competent prosecutors. What Baltimore gets is this reinforced notion that it's a city full of hopelessness, despair, and dysfunction, he said. Nina Noble recalled a rapport that frayed over time. The show's soundstage was originally hosted in an old Sam's Club, but was forced to move to Columbia after the third season when the landlord wanted the space for a retail tenant. "The unfortunate thing is I think we were sort of part of the end of showmaking in Baltimore," Noble said. "In other words, there were some incentives here, not in Baltimore, but in Maryland, that ceased to be funded at the end of The Wire. Once O'Malley then became governor, he was not interested in funding this industry, and that's really unfortunate because there was a good crew based here, great locations, and infrastructure." The show injected millions of dollars into the city and offered sound to those either without a voice or with a muted one. "By choosing a real city, we declare that the economic forces, the political dynamic, the class, cultural, and racial boundaries are all that much more real, that they do exist in Baltimore, and therefore they exist elsewhere in urban America," Simon wrote in that same Baltimore Magazine article. The cast and crew soon reflected a working-class mentality. Michael Potts, Brother Muzon, once stood in the rain during a shoot. An overeager wardrobe assistant asked to hold an umbrella over him. Potts tried refusing her. He felt odd, but finally acquiesced after she insisted several times. Soon, Potts spotted Noble signaling to someone and that person beelining toward him. "Nina says for you to hold your own umbrella," Potts recalled the crew member saying. "We don't do that stuff. That's L.A. stuff." The show stayed away from Hollywood. The city adopted the cast and crew and became home to some of their best, most challenging work. The spotlight also created a pressure cooker, and the city served as a locale to occasionally blow off steam. Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
"People ask me, what was the best character on the show? I always say Baltimore. It helped us all stay really tuned into what we were doing and what we were talking about. It can be any city. What we were talking about happens everywhere. Right now, we're in Baltimore, and we're talking about it. The first time I got to Baltimore, coming from the Bronx, I had an idea. In my mind, I'm not scared to go in any hood. I know what a hood looks like. I asked my boys about what Baltimore's like. They were like, Baltimore is a place where you sell drugs, and you get more bang for your buck if you go to Baltimore. When I went there, they fucked me up. When I got to Baltimore, I took the Amtrak. I got to the neighborhood. I started seeing where we were shooting. I started looking around. The feeling of Baltimore at that time was so despair. So we're not trying no more. It is what it is. This is where we live, and who gives a fuck? People just drive through. People on their way to D.C. or New York. We're forgotten. At that time, I didn't know what the mayor was doing. But at this point, when we got there in 2001, there was these big billboards that said, believe, keep trying. We had subliminal messages saying, don't give up. It looked like something out of a Clockwork Orange or some shit. I was like, what's happening? I saw this half a building torn up and somebody coming out the building locking the front door. I'm like, what the fuck are they locking the front door for if the other half of the building is rubble? In my junkie garb, I would walk by some kids and they would look at me with a look on their face. I'm talking about 9-year-olds and 7-year-old kids looked at me like I was their uncle. Wasn't scared of me, just giving me a dirty look like, move on, junkie. I was like, this place, they don't care. It is what it is. That just broke my heart. That just made us feel like you don't want your world to end up like this, when nobody gives a fuck anymore. That's what Baltimore felt like. As we got on telling the stories and when the show started airing, you start feeling different. People start feeling like, they're talking about Baltimore. We matter. This is our show. They started taking a little sense of pride. People was like, I saw the front of my house on your screen. On one of your episodes, I saw the front of my house. Shit, I got to clean it up. We started seeing and feeling that. Even people that didn't like the show. People were complaining about it, but they were talking about it. We don't like your show because you're showing the bad parts of Baltimore. At least they were talking. Before, they were just not giving a fuck. Now they're fighting for it. You felt the energy coming back to the city somewhat. It's one of those cities where the architecture is beautiful. It looks different at different angles. It has so many different looks to it. The people are the most honest people. There's no lying in the people. It's just that at one point or at some time, it was a forgotten city. They got John Waters. You had rich characters coming from Baltimore. Tupac Shakur. You got one of the greatest performing arts schools there. It didn't feel like it was being talked about. Nobody was giving it a look. Now, all of a sudden, it's starting to get a look because The Wire was giving it so much attention that we felt the city was starting to care more. They enriched us with us being a part of that. We would walk around. We became these little heroes of Baltimore. We got mad love. It was awesome. It was awesome to feel like you were a part of some sort of rejuvenation or some sort of pride about a place.
Fredro Starr, Marquise Byrd Hilton.
Filming in Baltimore, that itself was an experience. Baltimore is one of the, I would say, less financial cities. It's broke out there. Everything is torn down. It's not a lot of businesses. I don't know about now, but when we shot The Wire, it was like living in the past. It was kind of like a third world country to me, almost. Just cracks on the sidewalk. When you come out your trailer, bums, crackheads, gangsters, all by your trailer. Me personally, coming from the hip-hop group Onyx, the hood knows me from Onyx, too, so it was like, yo, what's up, Fredro? I'm out there mingling with everybody, being a part of the community, not just in my trailer, because of who I am as far as what I do in hip-hop. It was an experience in Baltimore. It was an experience just being out there. It was kind of like, wow, this is very real out here. They picked an ill place to shoot this shit. They could have shot on set somewhere that looked like the hood and put fake crack vials on the floor and busted glass on the floor, but that was all real. When I got thrown on the floor in one of the scenes, I was coming out of the store. Glass was by my face. It was like, hold up. Let's shoot the glass. It was real. Like, oh, this shit is hell.
Steve Schill, director.
What would typically happen is you're sitting there at 4 o'clock in the morning at some miserable street corner that's either 110 degrees in the middle of the night or it's snowing. But they're saying, Steve, what line are we picking up from? my little joke with them, I'd say, "We're going to pick it up from 'I'm going to pop a cap in your bitch ass.'" They'd say, "Picking up from 'I'm going to pop a cap in your bitch ass.'" "Where are we going to cut?" I would turn the page and decide, "I think we're going to cut on 'You're a motherfucker. I'm going to bitch slap you upside your head.'" We had some laughs about that.
Joe Chappelle, director and co-executive producer.
When David and all the writers, when they would write something and it was on a corner, whatever the street corner was, we would shoot at that corner. It wasn't like we go to a fun location and put up fake signs. We'd go to that specific corner.
Uta Brisewitz, cinematographer.
I remember coming out of a scouting van, and the van pulled forward a little bit and pulled over an empty plastic bottle. The plastic bottle made a pop, and instinctively, Robert Coulsberry went for cover. I remember finding that incredibly amusing. Not so much anymore. After I'd been involved more and worked on The Wire for a while and witnessed and experienced what, obviously, Bob already knew. If you hear a pop and you are not quite sure whether it is a shot or not, you had better duck for cover. Later on, we lost locations because row houses simply would burn down. It was just all very, very real. You really immersed yourself into the culture. It was not always a very pleasant environment to be in. The houses that we would shoot in, where characters would shoot up in, you would step on syringes and vials and everything. It was there. Everything was just real.
Leo Fitzpatrick, Johnny Weeks.
Walking from set to the trailer, I don't think we ever had any kind of security. We just blended in with the other people in the neighborhood. When I was in Baltimore, it was fine, but sometimes I would have to run to get the train back to New York at night, still kind of, not in wardrobe, but in makeup. That's when you notice the difference of how people looked at you. In Baltimore, in those particular streets, it was fine. But if you were on Amtrak looking like that, you noticed people changed seats and kind of separated themselves from you. At the end of a shooting day, I would have a beer. I'd walk into a deli or a liquor store and buy a beer. Nobody batted a lash. Nobody looked at me crazy. They just assumed, all right, here's just another white kid junkie. I think the white thing threw them off more than being a junkie. They were like, what are you doing in this neighborhood, kid?
Kwame Patterson, Monk Metcalf.
Season one, they said they were shooting a scene with the cops and somebody had just robbed somebody. He was being chased by the police and he had pretty much got away and he turned a corner and he was on The Wire set. He saw all these police officers and he just lay down on the ground and gave himself up. And he didn't realize until the other cops caught up that those police officers were actors. I know he felt so stupid when he was in jail, because they say he had gotten away. The real cops were so far behind him that he was gone.
Uta Brisewitz, cinematographer.
I remember going up to the location where we were shooting, and we were held back a couple of blocks away from where we were supposed to shoot. Two things happened. One, I couldn't get closer because there was a sniper somewhere on a roof, and they were trying to get the sniper off the roof. Another time, they were clearing out a dead body. Those are two things that happened.
Dominic Lombardozzi, Detective Thomas Herc Hauck.
We were shooting once, and two blocks over, you see cop cars flying and gunshots kind of simulating what we were doing. It was just happening two blocks over for real.
J.D. Williams, Preston, Bodie, Broaddus.
I'm from Newark, New Jersey, so we have a certain level of harshness or brutality, exposure to those types of things. Anywhere I go, most places are easier to adapt to than Newark. Most places I go just might be missing something. Like maybe the store closes too early, or you can't buy this or find that. As far as the trouble and danger and things you get to see, you kind of get used to certain things. Baltimore just reminded me of home, basically. And then it took me that first year to get used to Baltimore.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
Growing up in Newark gave me those layers. Being able to see real shit on a daily basis made it something that I was comfortable with. That was normal. So being in Baltimore and in that environment, it wasn't something that was strange. It wasn't foreign. The dialect, being around it a little bit more, they might move a little different, talk a little different. You've been in one hood, you kind of, sort of been in them all. Some are different than others, but for the most part, poverty is poverty.
J.D. Williams, Preston, Bodie, Broaddus.
Baltimore closed down 2 o'clock sharp, and I mean sharp. So I came outside of the club one night, not moving fast enough for the police, or just not being where I was supposed to be. The police, they grabbed me, slammed me down into the gutter. I was dressed up. It was a nice suit, and they slammed me down into the gutter, put the ties on me, and threw me in the truck, and they held me there. That was 2 o'clock when they took me in, and I didn't get out until about 10 o'clock in the morning. I had to walk home. My point in that story was about how the police, particularly Baltimore police at that time, how they just respond without thinking and with force. It could have turned really ugly and really dangerous really quickly. Thank God it didn't. I'm sure that type of occurrence was common, if it's not still common now. But that was my first year down there, so I had to learn Baltimore quick.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
The strip club, filmed in season one, I have to say, is a real strip club about 2 blocks from my house, but I never really frequented. We scouted for that. We found the most urban one on Eastern Avenue, what is called the Ritz in reality, and we really liked it. They were really game to let us film there, and the thing is, we knew we would be filming there several times, so it's different than just a one-time thing. They really have to want to put up with you. And part of it was we were going to spiff it up a little, add some lights and decorate it a little. So we filmed at the strip club. While we were filming at the strip club, the owner got charged federally with money laundering and was put in jail, and the FBI took over the strip club. So for the next 6 months, because of course we weren't finished with the season, we had to deal with the FBI as our landlords.
Wood Harris, Avon Barksdale.
It's funny, because we didn't really use the strip club as much. We never saw actual dancers in there, just actors whenever there was any dances. We used the upstairs area of the strip club. It ended up being like any other set. The only thing is, because that was a popular place, sometimes people would show up for us, the actors, and wait outside for hours and hours and hours until we came out. We started seeing some fanfare occur every so often. You get the PA come up to you. Wood, Idris, there's people waiting outside. Oh, yeah? Okay. We don't think anything of it. Then, 6 hours later, they're still outside.
Idris Elba, Stringer Bell.
Eventually, Wood and I would hang out, and we were like buddies and friends, even though our characters were best friends and were going through stuff. Wood and I spent time outside of the set hanging out. He was into music, and I was into music. We used to write songs, a couple of songs. I don't even know where those songs are. We had a couple of songs that we get together when he was rapping and I was rapping. Overall, it was a really good relationship and good chemistry.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
There was quite a strip club culture. Chubbies.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
I'm grown now. I can say that shit. I went. They took me out, man. They took me out. They let me see the strip clubs and be in that environment. We called it character development. K character research. We would go down to some of the strip joints and have a good time.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles' cousins.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We're playing these characters that you know were out and about in the streets and talking shit. It's all part of the method acting. We all logged it into research. We're just doing research.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
Wendell and I had to judge a pretty pussy competition there once, I remember that. We took it really seriously and were very technical about it. Six girls bend over. It's brilliant.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
We look forward to Baltimore because we knew we would have a good time. Let's paint the town red. Let's go for it. It was a boys' weekend that lasted for 6 months.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
It really was a bit tricky. I wasn't with the mother of my daughter, but my daughter. She was only 3 or 4, so I really missed her. 3 weeks was the maximum I could be away without going mad. I had a lot of jet-lagged weekends, just come back for a day or two just to see her. And that was pretty tough. And then I'd be spending most of my time fighting off sleep and jet lag and trying to brave it out. Then she came out whenever there was school holidays. That wasn't great, but I was single, I hastened to add. The only drawback was that I did miss a lot of her years of a 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old. That was pretty tough.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles' cousins.
We used to get hammered. You do some positive stuff, and you also let go of some steam. We got fucked up. JD, he challenged Idris to a drinking contest. Somehow or another, it was Idris and JD, and they were arguing about some shit. Either about John Madden or about hip-hop. They start talking about drinking. I believe JD started having visions of some shit. He started having visions and went under the table fearing for his life. Like Pokemon was coming to get him or some shit. He got fucked up. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot of moments that we just got tore up and we got to push in the envelope in so many aspects.
J.D. Williams, Preston, Bodie, Broaddus.
Me and Idris, we have a million stories. With the drinking contest, Idris is like 200 and something pounds. At the time, I might have been 140, 150 at the most, maybe. But I was a drinker. So I told him, let's go. So we went in. We downed a pint each. But then, after that first pint of Hennessy, I got probably through another quarter bottle, and he was still going. It was over. I was literally under a glass table looking through it at him. And a couple of other cats came in. Andre came in. I think Larry Gilliard was there. Hassan Johnson might have been there. I'm looking at all of these guys from under the table, through the glass, and they're all cracking up at me. I woke up the next morning in the middle of my floor in my underwear. It looked like my clothes exploded off of me or something. And I had to make some phone calls that morning, asking the guys what happened the rest of the night. The last thing I remember was being under the table. I had a little cut on my forehead.
Idris Elba, Stringer Bell.
JD was my guy, man. We used to hang out a lot. He just liked being with the old actors and talking shit and whatnot. He used to rag on me for being English and said, you guys can't drink. I think we poured a couple of bottles of Henny and started doing shots and seeing who would last. He didn't last, just put it that way. I don't remember how he got under the table. I just know that he was 3 sheets to the wind.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
Idris is a big man, yeah? Yeah, he can drink his drink. No, there was quite a lot of that. I mean, everyone was away from home. In my case, I was really missing home. I was really missing my daughter, so you tend to go out at night. And there were some titanic drinks and boozers among the cast and the crew particularly. And then, of course, once the show was a bit better known, Every bar Wendell and I went into, we'd be bought whiskey constantly. People would be constantly sending over Jameson, and I still get that now, so it was hard to stay sober.
Andre Royal, Reginald, Bubbles' cousins.
When Seth got in, he was like Rage Against the Machine. You couldn't fuck with him. When Seth got drinking, he loved you so much he'll punch you in the face. I punch you in the face and you punch me back because we love each other. He was one of those dudes.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
One time, we were out with Wendell and Sonia and Andre and a few other people. I wasn't paying attention, but I went over and Wendell was weeping. I was like, what did Andre say? And he was weeping because he had offended Andre and he didn't realize it. And he was feeling very badly about it. And he was apologizing to him. And Andre was looking at him like, you fat fucker. And I looked at Andre and said, where is your compassion?
Doug O'Lear, FBI Special Agent Terrence Fitzhugh.
For the most part, I was hanging out with the cop side of the actors, but they were all partiers. As soon as they cut, or Friday night came, we were partying till 6 in the morning, and then you could get a couple hours sleep and go on set. It was a party atmosphere. I had actual friends in the FBI, and I'd invite them all the time, like on Friday night, and they would always get so pissed off at me. Dom and some of those guys were paranoid, too, because they were much more in the limelight than I was. Going out and getting hammered, doing the fun stuff we'd do, a lot of it was illegal. You don't bring an FBI agent. I had to stop doing that after a while, although I've got to tell you, the FBI agents were just as rowdy. It was crazy. Behind the scenes, they're human.
Fredro Starr, Marquise Bird Hilton.
My niggas Hassan, JD, and I went down to Baltimore, and I hadn't seen them in a while. We all blazed in my room. The whole floor smelled like weed, and HBO told me to move hotels. I did, and they blazed up the room again. I think that's why I got wrote off the show real quick. I do think they probably thought I was a handful, or maybe too much to handle. Maybe. I only did 2 episodes. Then they was like, you're going to jail or whatever. The writers wrote that because they were writing it every week, so they could have wrote that in. All right, let's just send him up to jail forever. He'll come out of jail when Jesus comes home. Something like that. I think maybe that might have played a part. Or maybe that was just the way they wanted Bird to be. A hitman. In and out. Back in the days, I'm not gonna lie, I was just doing a lot of other stuff. It was on my part, not even thinking. Whatever. Fuck it. We gonna blaze the hotel up. In corporate America, you can't do that.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
Lombardozzi and I both ended up talking to a couple of different police officers that said, because of the amount of time they spend together, and because of how much they had come to rely on each other, that they could basically finish each other's sentences, that they were more like married couples in terms of how much they knew about each other and how familiar they were with each other. Dom and I wanted to have that sense on screen, that we knew each other real well. And to do that, living together seems to be the best way. And also, we didn't figure the show would go on very long, and it was cheaper to do so.
Dominic Lombardozzi, Detective Thomas Herc Hauck.
It was season 1, so we both rent an apartment together. Seth is really heavy into the football video game Madden. I kind of played. He turned me into a maniac with it. We kind of left our door open for whoever wanted to come and play, so Corey Parker Robinson would come, Michael Kay, Andre, and Hassan Johnson. There were 2 types of groups. The other one was with Clark Peters. They were very bohemian, which we enjoyed. Clark Peters, I love him. I used to love his house. It was just a different vibe there.
Clark Peters, Detective Lester Freeman.
We were given a stipend for each year, and it just seemed to make sense that if the amount of money that you're spending on rent is equal to the amount of money that you could be spending on a mortgage, what would you do? I am, after all, Lester Freeman. Follow the money, buddy.
Neil Huff, Chief of Staff, Michael Steintorf.
I was living with Clark Peters and Reg E. Caffey on North Calvert. I basically took over Jim Trufrost's room after he was gone. Reg E. would always get recognized in Baltimore when we were walking. They would kind of say, "Oh my God, I love you." They would then turn to me and do a double take and go, "I hate you. I hated you." If I'm ever recognized for The Wire, that's generally the second sentence. "I fucking hated you, man."
Clark Peters, Detective Lester Freeman.
It was a five-bedroom house. I myself don't need five bedrooms, despite the fact that my son and wife were coming out. That still left three bedrooms that were just there. People were coming in and out. Some of them were there for weeks on end, sometimes just for a couple days. Anytime someone came on in, like John Doman or Jim Trufrost, they'd hole up at the Tremont. I said, "Look, whatever you're paying at Tremont, pay me half of that. Come stay with me." The one who took it up first of all was Reg E. Caffey in the fourth season. Reg E. and I was pretty much the mainstay of that house for those last two seasons. That helped. I wasn't looking to make money. I was just looking to make sure that we all had a place to stay, and that was that. The good thing about it is that for the first 2 years that we had it, we didn't have a television. All we had was a radio, guitar, some painting, a couple of bottles of wine, a fireplace, and conversation. What had happened was that we wound up finding ourselves organically creating this little salon kind of society, where we would read books and sit down and talk. We spent our time like that. It was really very edifying. I really miss that.
Neil Huff, Chief of Staff, Michael Steintorf.
Like the first night I was there, like 10 a.m. one morning, the sound of an alto saxophone was coming out of Reggie's room. I come out of my room, and the door was open. There was Reg E. playing his saxophone in his underwear, 10 a.m. in the morning, just loving life.
Reg E. Caffey, Norman Wilson.
We would paint. Clark's an amazing painter, and he would make everyone do a painting before the year was up. We painted. I played the sax and the guitar. Clark plays the piano and the guitar, and he was learning the bass. We grew grapes and made wine. We came up with five different film ideas because there was no TV. We would just talk with lots of wine drinking, lots of music.
John Doman, Deputy Ops William A. Rawls.
He's quite an artist. In the basement of the house, he had an art studio, and we'd all go down there. We'd all have our own paintings going.
Clark Peters, Detective Lester Freeman.
The only TV that came up was actually Dominic West's. That's because he needed some place to store his from one season to the other, and that stayed downstairs in the cellar. I think maybe somewhere in the fifth season, we put a DVD, used it as a monitor.
Neil Huff, Chief of Staff, Michael Steintorf.
With Clark, we had a lot of really, really great meals.
Clark Peters, Detective Lester Freeman.
A healthy body. Mens sana in corpore sano. A healthy mind is a healthy body.
4. Build a city. The Wire's second season proved disorienting for the few viewers who had previously tuned in. Prior storylines were nudged to the background. David Simon had pledged from the beginning to take The Wire beyond the norms of a typical cop show and planned to deliver on that promise. With season two, the series' focus largely shifted, a dynamic that persisted in subsequent seasons. The diminished camera time rattled the show's established actors, who had enjoyed their first taste of mild success, including Andre Royo and Michael K. Williams. They noticed, as did the tiny loyal audience, that their time had mostly been bequeathed to white actors and characters. Simon preached patience to the original cast. The second season would be the most watched of the series, although its ratings still lagged severely behind HBO mainstays such as Sex and the City. Season 2 highlighted the choking death of America's blue-collar working class and how a son could no longer necessarily trail in his father's footsteps in a post-industrial world. The series told the story through the decaying Baltimore waterfront, its unions, and the Sabatka family. In order to increase lobbying funds for a port expansion, Frank Sabatka, Chris Bauer, the leader of the Dockers Union, began smuggling goods for a shadowy figure known as the Greek. His erratic son, Chester Ziggy Sabatka, James Ransone, and his nephew, Nick Sabatka, Pablo Schreiber, turned to drug slinging as their opportunities to earn money legitimately dry up. Lester Freeman's line, "Of all the pieces matter," became apparent as the show progressed. Major Stanislaus Valchek, Al Brown, appears sparingly in the show's inaugural season, but becomes a central figure in season two. His petty argument with Frank Sabatka drives the plot and reestablishes the major crimes detail. McNulty, reassigned to a harbor boat, finds a floating body and links it to the deaths of 13 more young women, found in a can meant to be smuggled off Sabatka's dock. The season ends in the tragic dismantling of the Sabatkas, with Ziggy charged with murder and Frank killed after he agrees to become an informant and betray the Greek. The season hit home for Rafael Alvarez, who came up with Simon as a young reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Alvarez's father had worked as a tugboat engineer, his grandfather as a shipyard worker. The expectation had been that he would always have a job at Bethlehem Steel if all else fell. Alvarez opted for a buyout from the paper in 2001. Shortly after, Simon asked if he wanted to collaborate on a book about the docks and the death of the working class. Alvarez passed, as he was already planning to write a book on his family's maritime history, and Simon sold the show to HBO. Alvarez spent 2 years on the ships after leaving the paper, then joined The Wire as a staff writer. He saw his grandfather and father as Frank Sabatkas, people who worked their tails off so that he did not have to work with his hands. "I knew that this had been on David's mind for a long time," Alvarez said. "I knew that he wanted to somehow document the death of organized labor in a city like Baltimore, and I was thrilled when he decided to use the docks as the vehicle to tell that story." David Simon, creator.
"To be honest, I thought if they give me 13 episodes and I get to tell a singular story about the drug war in season one, and they cancel me, at least it'll be a single season. Until they came back to me somewhere in the middle of the first season after they'd seen 5-6 episodes and said, 'We're picking you up for another season,' that was when I was like, 'Okay, now I'm going to build a city.' I didn't know I was going to get more than one, and then I remember going back to HBO and saying, 'We're going to go away from this. We're going to go to the port.' That was after I talked to Ed, and I remember Chris Albrecht saying, 'Was that the plan?' to Carolyn Strauss, and she was like, 'It is now.'"
Chris Albrecht, chairman and CEO, HBO.
"Then, at the end of the first season, we went back and told David, 'Hey, you got to keep some of these characters alive, and let's see if we can do a totally different thing, but we can't just drop the story.' He then went off and figured out a way to have them both be parallel with a slight interweaving of them."
David Simon, creator.
I think Ed will confess he didn't want to do the second season. He was like, we just built this universe. We can do more with it. And I'm like, yeah, and we will. But if we stay tight on the Barksdale second season, then the show is only going to be about the drug thing. And it's going to veer into that us-against-them soap opera of a cop show. I said, we have a chance to build a city. To credit Ed, he fought and he fought and he fought. Then, the first moment that we started touring the port and talking to people and meeting the union guys, he was like, this is great, and I have ideas. That's Ed. You've got to lead him sometimes and go, we're doing this, Ed. I'm taking you by your shoulders. This is what we're doing. I already sold it to HBO. Let's make the best of it. Then he goes in and you turn around and he's in the middle of its guts chewing. That's who he is.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
We were wondering where McNulty would end up. I said he would end up on the boat. And the reason I said that was my dad bought a 22-foot-old wooden boat. I'm surprised it even stayed afloat. He would take us out when we were kids to go fishing in the Chesapeake Bay. By about 1 o'clock, the water stops rocking. It just bakes. It's hotter than hell. That damn engine wouldn't start most of the time. We had to have someone tow us in. There's a diesel smell. I hate boats, I said. That's where they're sending him, to the boats. And that gave us the docks. It was pretty easy after.
David Simon, creator.
Season 2, I knew I wanted to go to the death of work. Because where do these drug corners come from? They come from deindustrialization. Our economy no longer needs mass employment. The only factory in town that's still hiring and is always hiring are the corners. You can see the need for it, to show the economy shrugging people off. But did I know they were going to be port workers? No. In fact, the first thing I thought of was, I wonder if they'll let us do an assembly line. Because I had in mind the Blue Collar movie with Harvey Keitel and Yaphet Kotto and Richard Pryor. As it happened, the place that let us in to do a working class movie was the port. It was state-run, and they were for the film industry, and they wouldn't let us into other factories, so it ends up being a port. Did I have an idea that we were going to do a working-class story? Yeah. And that we were going to have a guy as the local union president? Yeah. But did I think it was going to be the United Auto Workers at first? My first thought about it? That's the adaptation that happens.
Nina K. Noble, executive producer.
We initially were turned down by the port. They had concerns about safety. It's not that long after 9/11, and they had a lot of different homeland security measures changing all their guidelines every day, so that was a nuisance for them, and they didn't want to be involved. The way we got permission was we rented a section of the port, an unused part of the port in Locust Point, and built a set there. By doing that, we became tenants, and I was able to start attending meetings of the Private Sector Ports Association as a tenant. By attending those meetings, I learned that a lot of the concerns that we have about making our days work and staying on budget were concerns that they also had. So I was able to forge some relationships there that made it possible for us to film.
Rafael Alvarez, staff writer.
My dad was a tugboat engineer in Baltimore Harbor for 30 years. A lot of it, I was reliving my childhood.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
We had a young assistant who had an inn at the docks. He took us down there.
Norman Noerlein, researcher.
There are checkers and there are longshoremen. There are two different things, completely two different roles, and we really focused on the checkers, but we couldn't get the checkers to talk to us. Finally, we set up a meeting where it was all the producers, all the writers, everybody was in the room. Simon, Burns, everybody. I was literally the last person in the line, just jotting down notes. The head of the union came down, shook everybody's hands, then he looks at me and he goes, are you Phyllis's son? I say, yeah. He's like, you can have whatever you want. You guys have complete access. This guy's Walt Binowitz. He went to high school with my mom, and my mom is this sweet, sweet person. They ran in the same circle, so when Walt's mom died, my mom wrote a letter saying how much Walt's mom meant to my mom and how friendly they were. Because of that, Walt Benowitz gave us complete access to information.
David Inslee, director of photography.
Everybody was invested in the show. Most of the crew was there from day one and lasted all the way through. They were all invested in it. They looked forward to it. They did whatever. They went beyond doing whatever was needed to make the story because we all felt like it was a mission, something important to get across to the viewing populace.
Laura Schwegman, script supervisor.
One thing that I loved about working with David is that we work really, really hard. He works just as hard right next to you. He works just as hard, if not harder, than you do. When Bob Colesbury and David and Ed would be in there in the preliminary meetings, talking and working, just to kind of be a fly on the wall and see how passionate they were was incredible. You're telling this story. You're telling the story of someone's life. You're telling the story of a community, and that's different than, wouldn't it be cool if that happened? It's totally different than a lot of other things like, oh, this will be cool, that would be interesting. It's like, no, this is a story we need to tell, and it always related back to life experiences or things that they knew about or were involved in, which helped make it real. I remember we're doing this Russian piece once, and we're trying to get this Russian translation. The people that we were talking to for the Russian translation weren't getting what we were saying. I'm like, well, I live in Pikesville. Right next to where I live was this Russian neighborhood and Russian bakeries. We needed to know how to call somebody a pussy. The guy couldn't get it. The researcher, initially, he's like thinking, oh, it's a cat. No, that's not what I mean. He couldn't get what we were saying. I took the script and I drove to the bakery. First, I talked to the main manager, and he wouldn't talk to me about it because he was embarrassed. Then there was an older lady, and she was like, oh. Oh. She's going to get whomever. It was like her daughter or her niece in the back. A woman comes out. She's probably in her early 20s. I explained to her, I'm doing this TV show. There's this Russian, and there's a bunch of strippers, and we have to say these things. I need to know how to say it. She knew it, but she was so embarrassed to tell me. She's like, let's just go over here. We went into the corner of the bakery and she's pronouncing it for me and I'm writing it phonetically. Sometimes it was stuff like that that you had to figure out.
Norman Noerline, researcher.
If someone says, I need a three-legged blue pony, the only two questions you ask, when do you need it and how much are you going to spend? That's it. There's no other questions you need to ask me. One of the more interesting tasks I was given was, Uta Brisewitz, she's a wonderful, sweet, sweet person, and Nina said, we want to do something special for her birthday. Can you get her this cake made out of this German meat product? I was like, you want me to get a cake made out of meat? Yes. Okay, when do you need it? This afternoon. Great. Think about that. I can't call a bakery. This is a really interesting request. I called a place and said, I'm looking for this German kind of meat. Do you have it? They were like, yeah, we have it. We sell it by the pound. I said, great. Can you make it look like a cake? They were like, how many pounds of it? I go, I don't know how many pounds it is. Just can you make it look square, like a cake? I literally went to this place, got this meat cake, and took it to set. Everybody goes, what the hell?
Rafael Alvarez, staff writer.
We needed a crime to launch season two. You couldn't forget that it was still, in some ways, a story about police and criminals.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
I had one question I needed to answer. I knew the story in my head. We went to the management. After they gave us the whole dog and pony show, I said, can you steal one of these things off the docks? No way. Fuck. Then we went to the bar that night where the longshoremen were. Same question. Can you steal? The guy says, which one do you want? I said, there we are. That was the story. It was as simple as that. Everything flowed from that.
David Simon, creator.
I was able to vocalize the rule once we had a writer's room. A real writer's room began in the second season. It was a nicer new construct of what we tried over the first season. Once we had a full writer's room, I had to sort of express the rules. We had to say, It either happened, or it didn't happen, or it is rumored to have happened, but we're not quite sure. With all three cases, it could have happened. The parameters of this universe